welcome back to the program. One of the consequences of the vast numbers of men we incarcerate in America is that over 700,000 of them are being released from prisons each year back into society. Many have served long sentences and are woefully unprepared to integrate back into society, especially one that has little willingness to receive them. As changes in society come more rapidly, it's harder and harder for those individuals to adjust. The result is often increased rates of recidivism and a revolving door into the prison industrial complex. My guest, Sabine Heilein, has taken both a micro and macro look at the public policy consequences of this behavior. Her new book is Among Murderers, Life After Prison. Sabine Heilein's writing has appeared in the Iowa Review, the Brooklyn Rail, City Limits, and Tablet Magazine, and it is my pleasure to welcome her to the program today to talk about Among Murderers. Sabine Heilein, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Delight to have you here. Talk a little bit about how you got into this project. There were three specific prisoners that you focus on in Among Murderers, but talk a little bit about the backstory, about how you got into this as a subject.
Well, initially I was interested in looking at people in New York who don't work, who are unemployed, because New York is a city that is so determined in work. I mean, everybody works, and that's all people talk about. And I came across those classes called job readiness classes, and I didn't at first know what they were, and so I started to call up these agencies that facilitate the classes, and I very quickly figured out that they were for ex-cons, for people who have served long times in prison, and they were mainly to, you know, teach them soft skills, meaning like how to approach a potential employer, you know, how to shake hands, how to look in someone's eyes, how to fill out a job application, how to deal with the conviction question, things like that, and you know, in the breaks between the classes, I started talking to the students, and I very quickly noticed that the problems that people face are much larger than that, and, you know, that the job readiness classes really just scratched the surface. And I also knew at that point that nobody had really ever written about those seemingly mundane struggles of prisoner reentry. So, you know, I interviewed quite a few people. I mean, I would say at least 50 prisoners, ex-prisoners, you know, asking them questions how things have been going since they got out of prison. And eventually then, while I was reporting on a reentry event in Albany here in New York, I, you know, ran into Angel Ramos. And when I started talking to Angel, I sort of intuitively knew that he would be the right person and that he would be the protagonist of my book. And Angel then at the halfway house where he lived, the castle, it's called the castle, the halfway house.
Right.
So he became friends with Bruce and Adam. And yeah, so I sort of looked at their friendship, and it happened that they all had committed murders and all of them spent more than 20 years in prison.
One of the things that's so remarkable is not only did they not have skills as a result of being in prison for 20 plus years, but these weren't skills that they had before they went into prison. So in many ways, they were truly starting from scratch.
Right. Although I have to say that all three of them had come a long way and had, you know, I mean, Angel, for example, he started to read and write while he was in prison. He couldn't read or write when he was first incarcerated at the age of 18. But I think, you know, prison conditioned them in a certain way. I mean, there were certain instances of social behavior that for us is just second nature, while for them, they had to really learn how to do certain things on the outside. You know, I mean, certain things that, certain examples, for example, riding the subway that maybe in the neighborhoods where they were raised and then later in prison. Also, you don't stare at another person. You know, staring is considered, you know, a provocation, an invitation to fight. So that was something that particularly Bruce had to unlearn as he was released from prison and, you know, was riding the subway in New York. Everybody bumps into you and everybody stares at you, and so that was something, you know, that bothered him, and he had to tell himself that this is a different world and that he has to take it easy.
How often did you find that did any of these three, at various points when the stress got so great as a result of trying to acclimate to reentry, were almost longing for the simplicity of being back inside prison?
That was particularly apparent with Adam, who was the oldest one of the three men. He spent 31 years in prison, and he was like in his early 70s when he was released. And he really, and I should also add, he had already served several other sentences for robbery before that. He spent basically, I mean, he was in and out of prison since he was a teenager. And so he really had his, what he always called his family in prison. He, you know, was always referring to his family. And sometimes he said he misses his family, and life on the outside is just so stressful that sometimes he thinks it would actually be easier for him to be back behind bars. The other two guys didn't feel that way at all. They thought like a bad day on the outside is better than a good day in prison.
For the other two, particularly Angel and Bruce, what were the things that set up the most stress for them? What were the things that were the most difficult for them to emotionally adjust to?
For Bruce, I think it was to deal with his crime. I mean, that's another thing that nobody in prison really talks about, the crime people committed, which is kind of ironic because prison is the place where one should actually dissect, you know, what led up to that crime and like how to deal with it and how to change your ways and make yourself a better person. So for Bruce, when he came out, all of a sudden he had this, you know, big black hole of 24 years, and that was something he had to deal with. He would like want to socialize with people who had not been in prison. He didn't want to reconnect with, you know, the old crowd, and like a lot of people had died anyways. You know, people would ask, so what have you been doing? What have you been working? And so there was no easy answer really to that question. How do you fill a big black hole of 24 years? So that was certainly one of the biggest struggles for Bruce.
And how did they learn to answer that question?
I think slowly. You know, I with Bruce, it was, he had to, I think that was why he was so hesitant about getting into a relationship with a woman, because he knew if he wanted to have a big, a meaningful relationship, an important relationship with a woman, he would have to answer that question. And I feel like, you know, I was the one who was there at the time when they were struggling with those questions, who, you know, was pretty much the only person who was actually talking to them about that question, what it feels like. So, I mean, those men don't really want to make themselves vulnerable. So Bruce really struggled with addressing that question, and we talked about it a lot. And one of the things is, you know, you can never forget your prime, but you have to learn how to carry the guilt of having taken someone's life. Angel, on the other hand, each of them responded very individually, very different from each other. Angel, on the other hand, like, he just didn't talk much about his crime. He just wanted to get over it and away from it. And, you know, he was very chatty and very charming, and everybody seemed to like him. And for some reason, he managed to make connections with the outside world without talking much about his crime.
At the castle, this halfway house in West Harlem, what was done to try and help these guys prepare and deal with this reacclimation?
So the castle is actually a pretty good halfway house as far as halfway houses go. So they had something called morning focus and evening focus classes. So the men would meet twice a day for, I think, half an hour or something, like 20 minutes. I don't know. I forget how long exactly it was. And discuss sort of the challenges that they're expecting, the things they were afraid of the day, and then how the day went at the end of the day. So I think that was very, very important. And then they also had caseworkers, of course, who would help them with certain things. But this is a very ideal situation. They also had weekly meetings with the whole group. So I think they were each other's support system also. I mean, they had friends who had experienced similar things, who were experiencing similar struggles in the free world. Ironically, you know, ex-offenders or ex-parolees are not supposed to associate with each other. So, you know, that's something that's one of the parole stipulations. So that makes it difficult. Like, technically, they're not supposed to hang out with each other outside of the halfway house.
What about advice and guidance from those who had been through the process, that had managed to successfully do this? To what extent was there a support system in that regard?
Well, a lot of these reentry organizations actually hire ex-offenders, you know, who have been out for a while. Although I have to say this is sort of a mixed bag. I mean, I had problems with the fact that often these job readiness classes are being run by ex-offenders. I mean, not because I don't think, I mean, I absolutely think ex-offenders deserve a second chance, but I think it's problematic to have someone teach a job readiness class who has spent most of their life in prison and who has little to no outside experience, like holding down a job and going to job interviews and things like that. So you know, that's something they try to do, to hire their own people, and those people then are supposed to be role models of successful rehabilitation. However, if you take a closer look, you know, the system is problematic, I think.
Was there anything that they brought out of their prison experience that in any way helped them in their efforts to find the job, an interest, a skill, things that might have carried over into the real world?
I think there were a lot of interests and skills that they learned in prison, but the problem is that if you have a murder conviction, it's virtually impossible to find a job. You know, as I said, like often the organizations hire their own people if they find them reliable. You know, it's more the other way around, that they actually learn some skills in prison and then have a problem finding jobs where they can apply those skills on the outside. I mean, they all have these folders full of job training and job certificate programs that they have attended while they were in prison, like welding classes, you know, computer operator certificate, stuff like that. But then, you know, they think, you know, they have this fantasy, oh, yeah, I'm well prepared for the outside world. I'm going to come out and I'm going to find a job. But what, you know, most employers, especially in the low wage workforce, do criminal background checks. So that's, you know, it immediately shows up. So the murder conviction, and who wants to hire a murderer? It's an incredible struggle.
How much more difficult is it for those that have been convicted of murder than it is for others that have been in prison for a long time for other kinds of crimes?
You know, I don't have any statistics, but from the anecdotal evidence that I've gathered, those people are primarily being hired by reentry organizations. And I think it is easier to say, you know, I had a drug addiction and now I've been in like a million programs and, you know, I've been clean for 15 years than to have a violent crime on your record. And even if you haven't committed a violent crime for the last 10 years, you know, who can tell for certain? You know, I'm playing devil's advocate here also, like, but who can tell for certain that a murderer is not going to snap again? And who wants to take the responsibility, quite honestly, if you're an employer and you're looking for someone and there's plenty of people out there who need a job? You know, what would be the reward in hiring someone who's committed a murder?
Talk a little bit about how the men deal with all of this, everything we've been talking about, from an emotional and psychological point of view, finding so many doors closed in their faces along the way, and really having limited possibilities for the future.
Again, like very differently, the way they deal with it. one thing, I mean, that I have to say, Adam had survivor benefits from his wife, so he didn't really need a job. But one thing that was very important to him is to help his prison family, to help prisoners. So he was really, and is still, really, really active in the reentry scene, trying to connect prisoners with outside services. And so that was something that he found important also as, a way to redeem himself. Of what he had done, and to have meaning in life. So I guess it all comes down to meaning in life. Angel started to study at John Jay College of Criminal Justice. He's getting a BA there. So, he has a community there now, I think. Another important part, is religion. So, Angel converted to Quakerism while he was in prison, so he had a community from that realm. Adam became a Muslim, so that was very important to him. He said not so much for the religion, but more for the discipline that the religion offered, and he needed that in prison to survive, and sort of the contemplation and centering yourself. So there's different ways, and it really depends on the individual how they deal with it.
What are the limitations on where they can go in terms of moving around the country?
As long as they're on parole, those three could not leave the five boroughs of New York. So they couldn't travel around the country at all. But now all three of them are off parole, and so they can travel wherever they want to go, if they have the money, of course, which is another problem.
Does that provide other options and other opportunities once they can do that, to leave New York, to move perhaps to somewhere in the West, to somewhere that they might be more anonymous, or where they might be more independent in terms of using the skill sets they have?
The criminal background check is available and rampant all over America. So that's one thing. And then I think just to readjust to life in New York took them so many years that I doubt that they would just want to leave and to reconnect. I mean, you still have that, as I call it, the big black hole of 25 years that you need to fill wherever you are. I mean, that is something actually that hasn't come up. None of them said they wanted to move away from New York. That was the city where they were born and raised, all of them. Mm-hmm. And that was the city where they try to reconnect to their lives or to other people.
It's interesting on a certain level that they didn't want to escape that, that they didn't have the illusion of a fresh start somewhere else.
Right. It is interesting. You're right. I mean, maybe... But I mean, also, like, New York was all they knew, and maybe that's what kept them here. But you would imagine, maybe, that they would want to go leave New York. I mean, one thing in terms of starting over, what I've been thinking about is, entrepreneurship, some of them, are very active in those terms, and they start to have their little stands at parades selling flax, or, mm-hmm. Or they sell CDs, or they get a van and then help people move, things like that. If you're up for that, not everybody is a business person, that's certainly an opportunity where people won't ask about your background, I think, and that's something that's important to consider, I think.
Mm-hmm. What about the age that they come out of prison? To what extent does that make a profound difference? You mentioned one of them being much older, and how much does that impact how they deal with these problems and these issues?
I think it impacts it enormously. I mean, apart from the fact that, of course, they're all individual personalities, and I think, if you've spent 40 years of your 73 years in prison all together, I mean, it's so incredibly difficult. I don't want to say it's virtually impossible, because I have hope, but it's very difficult to connect. I mean, which then poses the question, what are we doing keeping people in prison for such a long time? what do we want from rehabilitation, or why are we keeping people in prison for such a long time? Do we want to punish? Do we want to deter? Do we want to rehabilitate? I mean, those are questions I think, you know, society has to ask itself, because, I mean, apparently deterrence doesn't really work. Punishment, all right, but then up to a certain point, eternal, are we still punishing the people after they're being released from prison by not giving them jobs, by not giving them housing, by not supporting them, by not inviting them to our homes? Or do we actually want to rehabilitate people? And if we want to rehabilitate people, then we have to provide services accordingly from the moment they're being incarcerated, if that is our goal. And then we need someone who determines, you know, a psychologist who's worked with this person for a long time to determine at what point is that person rehabilitated. The way it works right now is that, you know, you go in front of a parole board every 2 years after you've served your minimum sentence, and then within 15 minutes or half an hour, a parole commissioner whom you have never met before and who's never met you determines whether you're ready to be released. This is a system, I think, that doesn't work at all. It costs a lot of money, and that doesn't work.
What about recidivism rates? Maybe not for the same crime, maybe not for murder, but what about the likelihood of these guys winding up back in prison for something?
Well, generally, the recidivism rates have been steady at about, 66% or something like that, so very, very high for the general prison population, people are being released. Murderers have a considerably lower recidivism rate of only, you know, for the same crime of only like 0.5%. There's different studies between 0.5 and 1%. From the studies I've read, the thing that seems to work the best in terms of recidivism is cognitive behavioral therapy, which has a success rate of 30%, which might not sound like much, but it's actually a lot, 30%. But this is a service that's virtually not provided in prison.
What are the services that these guys would like to see? If they could wave a magic wand and we could make the appropriate public policy changes to make this reintegration easier, what would work? What would really help?
You know, I think housing works. There was recently a study released here on the East Coast in Pennsylvania about you know, halfway houses, and that halfway houses do not reduce recidivism rate. But then again, we hear all these like horror stories about like how halfway houses are being run. And of course, if you're in an unsafe place, you know, where your stuff's being stolen, where you're afraid to be beaten up, and where you're among drug addicts, it's not a big surprise that that doesn't work. So I would like to say that housing is still very, very important. And I think it's also important for these guys to have someone to talk to, because often they're being released and they don't have, if you've spent 25, 30 years in prison, you might not have family anymore, or your family might have like forgotten about you or turned away from you a long time ago. You know, you don't want to reconnect with your past, with the old guys in the neighborhood that you used to hang out with. So, you know, I think individual attention is very, very important for the guys. And also, you know, a place to just rest a little bit. I mean, to come out of prison is an incredibly stressful experience, because up to that point, all decisions were made for you, and all of a sudden, you know, you're thrown out, spit out into a world where you have to make independent decisions, which you haven't had to make for the last 25, 30 years. So I felt like, you know, they came out of prison and were immediately being forced into those programs where I felt like, man, give them a break, you know, let them, you know, sort of reassemble themselves a little bit before you force them into another regiment.
Sabine Heinlein, her book is Among Murderers, Life After Prison. It's just out from University of California Press. Sabine, I thank you so much for spending time with us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
I appreciate it. We'll take a break. I'll be right back.